Mormon Matters Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation and is seeking to build financial support separate from Mormon Stories Podcast. All donations to Mormon Matters are fully tax deductible and go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for Mormons like you. To support the podcast or to join the community, please become a monthly subscriber today at mormonmatters.org.
Welcome, everyone, to another edition of the Mormon Matters Podcast. I'm your host, Dan Weatherspoon, and you are about to hear hour three of a discussion with Dennis Potter and Jim McLaughlin on God, especially Mormon views of God versus some other models, particularly the omnipotent capital G kinds of gods that typically are thought of with that term. And the reason I'm saying you're getting hour three, you're getting it first, is that we, as sometimes happens when we get good friends together and people who really know subtleties of thought, they go into all sorts of crazy directions. Very technical, subtle directions, calling on a lot of background knowledge and things without stopping and explaining. And you'll kind of see, for anybody who wants to listen, we're going to release that other couple of hour of discussion as a part two of this for those who want to do it. But we're just going to try to take the best of that 2 hours and turn it into a podcast right now for a little bit more of a general feel and focusing just on four or five of the major thrusts of that larger thing. So I'll explain again what's going on. But for those of you who are here to have a good discussion of God and especially how Mormon God compares to others, we're thrilled to have Dennis Potter and Jim McLaughlin with us. So Dennis, would you quickly just tell us a little bit who you are, what you do, and then Jim, I'll have you follow up right after him with just kind of your main things about work and interest and thought.
Okay, I'm Dennis Potter. I'm an associate professor of philosophy at UVU and the associate director of religious studies there as well, and one of the co-founders of the Society for Mormon Philosophy and Theology.
For sure. Awesome. Thank you so much, and we're so glad to have you back engaging in these discussions with us. Jim?
I'm Jim McLaughlin. I'm a professor of philosophy at Western Carolina University in beautiful Cullowhee, North Carolina, off in the Smokies, I'm glad to be here.
Great.
I've been here before.
Yes, I was just going to say, both of you have been here before. Dennis, just one time, I think it was on the one where we discussed what is truth. And then Jim, at least four or five, everything from evolution to... Oh, I can't even remember, but you've been on lots of times and always a favorite. So thank you both for coming back. Let me quickly give the audience a quick note. Dennis Potter in mid-June did a series of Facebook posts, and it basically was along the ideas, is the Mormon concept of God, or is the Mormon God, however they conceive it, worthy of worship? And it generated some discussion, and I wrote to him and I said, hey, I'd love to do a podcast on this, are you game? And he said yes, but I knew that Jim was the best person who might be able to talk with Dennis about this. And Jim was off to Europe and having a good time and various things, weddings and who knows what, babies and things
babies.
Being born. Yeah, babies being born and all that. And so it's taken us a couple of months to get this conversation going, but I'm thrilled to have it. And so Dennis, let's use the worship piece, quite early in the discussion. Would you let us know, I know you've had an evolution in Mormonism. You used to be super committed to the LDS concept of a personal God, an embodied God, etc. So I'd love to have you talk a little bit about why that was such an attractive piece to you, and then take us a little bit into the three or four critiques that you have of that that we'll then use for our discussion.
Yeah. Well, the way that I understood the Mormon God is that God's anthropomorphic, literally anthropomorphic, like just like a human being, but an exalted human being, and hence God is finite,
right,
and God is an environment. And one of the strengths of that view is that it solves the logical problem of evil. I'm not sure that it solves the evidential problem, but it solves the logical problem. And also, more importantly, it is a concept of God that people feel like they can relate to. When God, I mean, if God is a person, a human, or a human-like person, then it makes sense to pray to him. It makes sense to petition him in prayer. It might not make as much sense to petition Aquinas's God or the God of traditional Catholic theology, right? A God who is impassible and can't change his mind and so on. But it does make sense to petition the Mormon God and to have a relationship with him the way you'd have a relationship with another human being. And so those, it seems to me that those are the positive aspects.
What about one of the positive aspects, or is this actually a negative aspect for you, in that this is an exemplar of what we would see as a more abundant type of experience or a more abundant life, and there's an aspirational or a modeling, you know, this desire for models for us.
Oh, yeah, yeah. He's a more, like the Buddha is to Buddhists, God is a moral exemplar to humanity, right?
And that's a strength for you, as long as we wouldn't attribute a whole bunch of weird attributes to God, right?
That God, yeah,
okay.
Yeah. Okay. Well, yeah, I think so. But at this, you know, despite the fact that I think there are these positive characteristics to the Mormon concept of God, I think that there are some deep problems that arise from the fact that it's anthropomorphic and literally anthropomorphic. Much more, Mormonism takes anthropomorphism seriously and in a way is more logically consistent than the other Christian traditions that have anthropomorphic tendencies, like evangelical Christianity. Evangelical Christians, they petition God too. But in a way, it almost makes more sense for them to pray to the Mormon God than it would for them to pray to Calvin's God, right? Calvin's God doesn't really make much sense to petition him. But I think that there are some criticisms you can make of the anthropomorphic God. And in particular, I believe that you could never make the case, or that you can't make the case that a human-like God or an embodied God with a natural environment is the proper object of worship by all. And what I mean by that is, any embodied being, it would be an acceptable reaction to that embodied being, no matter how good and no matter how powerful, to say, you know what, I'm not going to completely submit to you. I might listen to you and take what you say to make sense or to take it very seriously, but I'm going to treat you like the Buddhists treat the Buddha. They venerate him, they respect him, they listen to him, but they don't worship him. And I think that that's true about the Mormon concept of God. And in order to explain it, let me give a scenario, a simple scenario that I think Mormons can understand. Imagine a devout Catholic who understands her theology really well. She dies. And then she goes to the spirit prison, of course. And in the spirit prison, Mormon missionaries are proselyting to her. And they're trying to explain to her that God, the Father, and not just Jesus Christ, is embodied. And she doesn't buy it. She says, no, God's not embodied. And I know, and you know, I've been taught this my whole life. That's part of the meaning of the word God, is that he's the greatest conceivable being. And clearly the greatest conceivable being couldn't be embodied. And so that could not be God. And of course, the missionaries could respond to this. Only Mormons could do this. They could respond to this by going and getting God and bringing him into the room to introduce God to this this Catholic. And it seems to me that even if they did that, even if she encountered this really morally exemplar person who had power and who had influence, maybe even if she remembered having a relationship with him, it doesn't follow that she would have to recognize that he is God. It seems to me that she could still claim that the greatest conceivable being exists and that that's really God, and that anybody who's embodied and limited in that way and contingent in the way that bodies are wouldn't actually be God, wouldn't be someone that you could place all of your devotion in, or in other words, love with all your heart, might, mind, and strength, and submit completely to. I don't think that it would be irrational for her to reject that, given the way she understands things. In other words, I think that even if the facts of the matter about Mormonism are correct, it doesn't follow that there is a God with a big G. And by a God with a big G, I mean one that would have to be worshipped by everyone.
Right. Jim, do you want to jump in with what I mostly want to focus on? So Dennis probably wins most of these arguments and statements. I guess my hope is that we'll say, is this really a problem for Mormons? That pretty much this kind of sounds like things that Mormons have no problem believing, that we don't necessarily even think that God cares about being worshipped.
Yeah, I like what Dennis says about Buddhism here, because I think in this respect, and I think this is why I think Mormons should actually talk to Buddhists sometime, is we're more like Buddhists.
Right.
Because what the Buddha would say to the Catholic lady would be, well, gee, this isn't going to get you very far, is it? You're so attached on this idea you have of the most worshipful being that you're going to stay here. And a Mormon would say the same thing. Was, well, that's a nice idea, but it's not going to get you where you need to go. And if we can't convince you, that's all right, but you'll stay where you are. You
know, and by where here, we means who you are, the level of empowerment that you are, the level of enjoyment you are, not physical, you're in a prison, not go to a heaven. It's simply you're gonna stay at this growth place that you're at.
You think about, oh gosh, what was it, the Vanity Fair, you remember Thackeray's book, and I'm trying to remember the names of the characters here, but there's Becky Thatcher. Becky Thatcher is the kind of loose woman in it, but she has a friend who her husband was kind of a cad, but she puts him as the kind of most, she worships him. And so, but her husband's killed just before the Battle of Waterloo. And there's a man who loves her through the whole book, who is, there. But she refuses to see this because she has this idea of what the perfect man would be until the end of the novel, of course, when Thatcher shows that, he was going to be unfaithful to her with her. Of course, you know, the Catholic woman would not think that her God would do that. But because she's got this wrong image in her head, and this is what the Buddha would say too, she's never going to experience the fullness of love in the way that it should be experienced. And, you know, we have a happy ending, sort of happy ending, not for Becky Thatcher, but for her friend at the end of Vanity Fair.
So Dennis, speak personally or just speak objectively here. You know, obviously in the Mormon canon and in Mormon parlance and Sunday discussion, we use the word worship. But I think, you know, my contention is that we use it in a loose way. We never really examine it. And so, if you were really kind of own up to Mormonisms, not own up in terms of like you're denying them, but there is a version of Mormon, you know, theology, a take on it, this limited God, I think you used the term finite, where we don't really get a sense of this God being so ontologically different from everything else that there would be this objective, you know, possibility that we would all need to worship this God. And it doesn't seem like we get that big a sense in Mormonism that God even desires to be worshiped. You know, we can look at the various scriptures that use the term worship or talk about it and stuff like that and simply say, well, that's a human reaction, that's a human discussion about it. But given the first principles of a God that simply says, here I am in the midst of spirits and glory, I find myself there, and, you know, here's how I got to be who I am, and I'm going to go sort of let others know through my example or through however I can communicate at whatever level it is, I'm going to let them know that here's an abundance of life and joy that's possible for them. There's just no sense to me in there that this is a God that needs to be worshipped, and, you know, worship worthiness of God just doesn't seem to be that big a deal for Mormons, at least given that view. So, you know, challenge me, but also make an argument for why worship is a bigger deal than I'm giving it credit for.
Well, I think one thing is you're just ignoring scriptural texts, and these are Mormon scriptural texts too. Mm-hmm. One, you know, the one that I cited, Deuteronomy 6:5, where we're supposed to love the Lord with all our heart, might, mind, and strength, and also the talk of bending the knee. And by the way, this language is also in the New Testament and in Mormon scriptural texts too. The heart.
Yeah, every knee shall bow and every tongue confess that Jesus is the Christ.
Yeah, and it doesn't. I mean, I can see how what you're saying is a heterodox interpretation of Mormonism, but it is certainly not the mainstream interpretation. And in particular, I think that for example, look at Blake Osler's work. And when I talk about mainstream, I don't necessarily mean the lay membership. I also mean intellectuals, people who can talk about God in a very sophisticated way. It seems to me that they do believe in kingship monotheism, as Blake calls it, which is the idea that there's this one being that we should love above all else, and that we should submit to and obey that being. Obedience is a big thing in Mormonism.
But isn't it only because that God has proven themselves to have higher thoughts than you, to have a bigger vision of you than you do of yourself? Isn't it only an experiential reason that you would ever choose to have that be the king?
Well, if that's the case, then you can't be sure that he'll continue to be like that.
Right, and we're comfortable with that.
If he really did, if he really did command Abraham to kill his son, then I would say, well, that's all the evidence I need that God is not good, and so I'm not going to worship him, right? Or if he commanded Nephi to kill Laban, same thing. So what I'm saying is that the fact that somebody's a moral exemplar is not on its own enough to recognize them as God with the big G. And by God with the big G, I mean the God above all other gods, the God that you should place your trust in above all other gods, such that if you don't do it, you're making a mistake.
Well, but what's the consequence of the mistake? I've stayed small. It's the same mistake that the example of the person in spirit prison is making. So there's no like condemnation, there's no hellfire and damnation, any of that kind of stuff. Well, I guess there's damnation in the sense that Mormons like to talk about a stoppage, there's really no negative consequence here, is there?
I don't grant that you can ever be in a position to know that you need to follow this particular being in order to live the best life just because he says so.
Well, that's why Mormonism is so grounded in find out for yourself. Do the experiment upon the word. Are energies flowing? Are you bigger? Are you having a richer experience?
I think that when Mormons say that, that's kind of disingenuous because they don't really mean it. Here's why. Here's why they don't really mean it. They don't really mean find out for yourself, because if you find out for yourself and you disagree with the church authorities, you're wrong. They're right. So you know,
the finding out for yourself is whether you can trust God. You know, I agree that absolutely most of folks are worrying about, am I in alignment with the brethren? But ultimately, our teachings is you only have to worry about being in alignment with God.
Yeah, there's a kind of an ecclesiastical and theological distinction here in that here, you know, just because I want to keep the group together, I have to be in conformity somehow with the group in order to do that. But, you know, I can claim that the group has gone wrong on this one and that I think that, you know, I should disagree with them because God asks me to, or because it's right, or because, you know, like with Kant on the Abraham and Isaac story, you know, from the point of view of religion, Abraham should have, you know, flipped God off at that moment. And God should have appreciated it. But I agree with actually both of you in different ways here, that we do emphasize in the church itself, obedience gets way too much play. But we can also look at obedience the way that section, 130 does, you know, when it says there is a law on which all blessings are predicated. You know, you can either look at that as there are different laws for each blessing or that there's one great law. And, you know, if we go back to Dennis's quote of Deuteronomy in the New Testament, also when the lawyer comes to Christ and asks him, what is the law? You know, what's the great law? And he says, well, to love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, might, mind, and strength. And the second is like unto it, to love thy neighbor as thyself. You know, if you cross-reference that with Matthew 25, man of grief, you're only doing that when you're in the service of your fellow man, you're in the service of God. you can't separate the two. It's impossible. And, you know, there are times in the church when I think that they ask us to separate the two, and we should not obey at those moments.
Yeah. A couple things come up for me, and one of them is, Dennis, you know, your initial thing was I'm chucking a whole bunch of scripture. And so I'd love to have an argument for the privileging of scripture. What is it that you know, either that your argument depends upon a particular view of scripture, so if you want to put it that way, or what is your particular view of scripture if this is a Dennis Potter critique rather than just a critique of, you know, the you got a long road hoe there, Weatherspoon, if you want to, you know, emphasize these particular scriptures over others.
Yeah, well, I think you're pulling this thing that Mormons often do, and that is and so and that is to use words that are used in the Christian theist tradition in a way that's different than the way they use them. So, for example, B.H. Roberts calls God omnipotent, but it doesn't mean the same thing that, that classical theologians mean by omnipotence. And so it's an abusive language. The same thing is happening here. I mean, you want to call God God, but the word God, it goes back to the idea of these beings that people in polytheistic traditions used to worship. They thought of them as their protectorates, right? Their overlords. And the whole move to monotheism, which is what happened with Judaism and then Christianity and then Islam, is a move to the idea that there's one God worshipable by all. One God, right?
But that's to say that the evolution of the term stopped there. You know, what Mormons would want to say is no, it didn't.
Well, but what I'm saying is you're disconnecting it from its history if you're going to say that worship is irrelevant.
I'm not saying irrelevant. I'm just saying, given what I sense is the basic, you know, sensibility of a God that, you know, organizes rather than creates for nothing, that it has other self-existing entities that, you know, some way or other have been attracted, you know, through a call, they have a response to this God. Somehow in that, there's this de-emphasis on, oh, hey, I'm the best above all, versus it's just like, hey, you came my way, know, and here's, I'm happy to share my secrets.
I don't see that you came my way in Mormonism. It seems to me that in Mormonism you do have the God that is the jealous God, the God that wants. I mean, because it's in the either those scriptures mean something, or you can just dismiss whichever ones you want, right?
Right.
It seems to me that those scriptures. I mean, the scriptures must mean something, and the word God must mean something, and the fact that Mormons use the word God with the big G must mean something. And if it means anything, it means, you know, that this is the greatest being, at least the greatest, not necessarily the greatest conceivable, at least the greatest being, the one that the only being that it's worth caring about, really, ultimately. And any other love that you put on anybody else is derivative of the love of that being.
Yet,
right.
Yet that being became the greatest because that being is the most loving of other individual entities. You know, it's
yeah.
Well, that's to me the Mormon God. That's how you became God. I'm like willing to be with you in the deepest, darkest, ugliest, you know, areas, and still show you that this is a rich, wonderful, the most abundant sort of life.
Well, I think Dennis.
But notice he had to become God, which means that he's dependent on other things for being God, and those are the things that our love really should be focused on then, because that's what would make us gods too. He's just then only a moral exemplar.
Only it's pretty important to be an exemplar.
Yeah, well,
and it's not a moral exemplar; it's an empowerment exemplar.
Empowerment exemplar. But the point that I'm making is that he's nothing more. He's not anything more than the Buddha is. He's not the God of theism.
It's just 1 minute. Now, he's not the God of traditional theism. That's the point. And I think that you can see the tradition as developing and changing all along here. You know, you talk about moving from polytheism to monotheism, but even within monotheism, I mean, you know, it's a very slow move through the Hebrew Bible toward Isaiah finally making the claim that there's only one of them, and then into intertestament Judaism, and then Christianity, and then classical theism in the Middle Ages, and then what Mormons are doing. And yeah, I think we do use the words differently than the rest of the Christian tradition did. I mean, I remember discovering this in graduate school, and it was a moment of, it was a real moment of revelation for me that I didn't mean the same thing by almost every word I used from what they were saying, God, right. Omnipotence, worship, go down the list. But one of the important things too is, and it is a problem we have, but I think it's actually an important and problem that I wouldn't want to get away from. Mormons don't think that the scriptures are infallible. We got to wrestle with them. Sometimes, a lot of times we treat them as infallible, but, ultimately we don't believe they're infallible. So there's all sorts of weaknesses and problems in them. Brigham Young said that if they were the Book of Mormon was translated,
it would say
different things. There's a continuity there that you can trace through a kind of evolution of thought. And you can identify themes, but it's not that it exists there as a kind of ideal whole that has never changed.
So it sounds like to me that both of you, and I don't think all Mormons are like this, but both of you are willing to give up the idea that God the Father is God with the big G.
Yeah.
I think if you give that up, I think that really what makes that term have its meaning, God with the big G, is its exclusivism. That's what makes it get its meaning, is the fact that it's exclusive. And so if you give that up, you're giving up exclusivism. And of course, Mormonism is famous for taking an exclusivist view.
No, but you could say that
Joseph Smith, the whole idea of the Restoration was that there was an apostasy, that everyone else got it wrong, and that the truth needed to be restored. And now we've got it right, they've got it wrong. That's why Mormons go and proselyte in Christian countries.
Yeah, but
because
the Buddha,
they're not really Christians.
I really like your Buddhist analogy here, because the Buddha, Buddhists are missionaries too. The three great missionary religions are Christianity, Islam, and Buddhism. And the Buddha says, this is the way to do it. But as we say, the Buddha is a human being who became enlightened. And later in Northern Buddhism, you get the number of Buddhas is greater than the sands of the sea. I think Mormons in a lot of ways understand God in ways closer to Buddhism than they do to traditional Christians or to Muslims. I mean, there are some ways that they would be closer to Muslims than traditional Christians, but there are ways that, the Buddhist analogy that you made, I think is excellent for this. Also, let me go back to one thing about worship again. And we've had the romantic discussion, but I would rather love my wife than to love. I would rather worship that character who is that moral example, who had a history the best history we know for Mormons here would be Christ, who lived a life, who suffered, who went through temptation, but still loved. I would rather love him than to love his attributes. It's that history that I would focus on.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a way to use the term worship.
Yeah. But you wouldn't love no matter what, right? I mean, like somebody that you loved, if that person became, a mass killer.
Asshole. Yeah,
in other words, the love is not above all else necessarily in those cases.
But it is tied to the individual and who they become.
Yeah, see, I think it would see...
Same with the Buddha.
From my view, it would make sense to worship a being that is the author of everything, a being that is such that everything else that exists depends on that being for its existence, and that and a being that is the actual author even of goodness and so on. In other words, the traditional Catholic God. It would make sense to love above all else and with all of your heart, might, mind, and strength, that kind of being. But a being that is within an environment and is dependent on that environment, it doesn't make sense to worship in that sense, right? It only makes sense to test out what they say. Okay, yeah, so maybe it looks like he might be right about this. I'll check it out and see if he is. He is right about this. That's what the Buddha says you ought to do about his teachings. He says, yep. Look, I'm going to teach you these things. Try it out for yourself and see if it works. If it doesn't, you know, there's nothing I can say to you. But that's different than the missionary attitude that Mormons have. The proselyting attitude is, we're right, you're wrong. The exclusivism is grounded in kingship monotheism, I think.
And I think we're wrong when we do that.
Okay. Yeah. Well, yeah.
And ultimately, yeah. I think every missionary kind of learns, Dennis. Yeah, you think you go out there, we're preaching the truth, and we have it right, and they have it wrong. And I think ultimately what happens is you realize that all your conversions, really, well, almost all of them, maybe there's a few, you know, people that are really intellectually oriented or something, but all your conversions is like, hey, I want something more. I want something bigger. This has come into my life, and it's given me a new model, a new sense of myself. As good, as important, as divine. Those are the kinds of things that I think they actually do the conversion things. And if you want to look at Jesus' initial call to the apostles, and some Mormons are just, you know, following the call from Matthew to go into all the world and things like that. Think of Christianity and really what Jesus was doing. This is a new way of relating to each other. This is a new possibility. We are not slaves. We're not, to be a conquered or a colonized people and things like this. This is a new ethic, you know, all the truth, the way, and the life, any of that kind of stuff. That's, you know, it has nothing to do with the nature of the cosmos, and it's always about ethics and about people. And so Mormon exclusivism, I'm willing to give it up because, you know, all I could do is offer it to somebody and say, this is what made me feel better, and because of my outward focus that kind of comes from the core of my being, because of this connection with this wider thing that I somehow feel that I'm completely a part of, by choice, by my own orientation and stuff like that, I'm sharing with you. And, you know, saved or damned, Mormonism ultimately gets rid of all that stuff, and it's simply of, you know, you're resurrected by law. What law are you willing to receive? Look at section 88 in those, you know, verses in the 20s and things like that. Would you, you refuse to receive more than this? And it's always our choice. And I just love that piece of Mormonism.
It's still hierarchical and still involves a judgment.
But the hierarchy doesn't. The hierarchy is more withness rather than higher or lower, and all the judgment, at least according to, again, we're picking and choosing certain scriptures, but there's certainly a piece within Mormonism that says God isn't judging, we're judging by what we're willing to choose. And again, and there's no fixed, you know, if we have this idea of eternal progression, and of course, you know, it's out of vogue to talk about jumping between kingdoms, and I think it's terrible to even be talking about kingdoms to begin with, because it focuses on, you know, place and rewards and mansions instead of empowerments. But ultimately, I think our gospel says this is all about how big of beings we want to be, how much of others do we want to relate to. That is what this is all about. And so any of these hierarchies and judgments and things like that, I think our metaphysical position of uncreated beings, there's nothing that could destroy us except our own choice. We can choose to get small, 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 and maybe that's what sons of perdition mean, you know, outer darkness, you'll ground up into original matter or whatever that Brigham, you know, wanted to do. But there's nothing at stake here that involves a God judging us, I don't think.
Well, yeah, but that's not the Mormonism I taught when I was on my mission. I mean, I ask any average Mormon, is the celestial kingdom better than the telestial kingdom? And they would say, yeah.
Sure. But ask anybody, is it really a more profound teaching to say, are you a celestial person or you went to the celestial kingdom? In other words, there's plenty of people that say, well, I wouldn't be comfortable in the celestial kingdom. I go where I'm comfortable. And that's, to me, one question moves anybody off what you just said is the position and moves them towards the direction that I'm arguing.
Yeah, well, it would be nice if all Mormons believed what you believe, but they don't. And when you're criticizing a religious tradition, you can't be expected to criticize the heterodox views in addition to criticizing the orthodox views. And I think the view that you're expressing now is a heterodox one. I think most Mormons hearing what you're saying right now would say, well, that doesn't sound like the Mormonism I know.
Within 10 minutes,
I don't buy that because I've talked a lot. I was in Mormonism for quite a long time, and I interacted with those people, and I don't buy the idea that you could easily convince them to the view that the celestial kingdom, the terrestrial, and the telestial kingdom are all of equal value, and that celestial beings, terrestrial beings, and telestial beings are all of equal value. No, they seem to, there's a strong element of judgment. They talk about Jesus Christ being the judge all the time. There's a strong element of exclusivism in Mormonism, and if you ignore that, you're taking a heterodox approach. Not that it's illegitimate to take a heterodox approach, but you are taking a heterodox approach. Don't pretend that it's the Mormon view.
Well, you know, that's something that I think anybody is faced with, though, is that we're always kind of in dialogue with the religious tradition that we're in, but we're always also in sort of tension with it, in that, we're trying to find what we think is the truth within it. And, we have to listen to others. Like, we mentioned Blake Osler. I like a lot of what Blake has to say, and some of it I just don't like at all. I listen to Conference. I like a lot of what's in there, and some of it I don't like at all. But that's almost unavoidable. I mean, even for Mormons who say they buy everything, it's hard because the guys in Conference don't really agree with each other all the time. You know, it's been correlated, but you've got to just do the best you can. And you always end up saying that I think this is what Mormonism really is. It's the best I can make it to
be. Yeah, well, and you have to say that. And of course, if Dan's and you are right about what Mormonism is, then I'm not really critical of it. It's the Mormonism that I'm critical of is the Mormonism that I grew up with, that I was taught in the church manuals and in correlation and that I taught on my mission and that I get all the time. Mormon community, Mormon culture is a very judgmental culture.
Well, at least it is.
They're worthy for the temple or they're unworthy for the temple. People are righteous or unrighteous and all of that. And it all traces back to this kingship monotheism, which is at the base of it. And I think that it's fundamentally problematic unless you have a God like the Catholic God. And then you can kind of make sense out of it. But if you don't, if you've got a God who had to become God, had to figure out how to become God, we figure out how to become God and we could do it independent of him. There's no reason why we have to listen to him.
Absolutely. There isn't. I'm willing to go there. Can I do a progression of thoughts just for a second? Dennis, other than, fresh converts or something, somebody who's been in the church 10 or 15 years, if you were to sit there and tell them, what are some of the differences between the LDS God and, traditional theism or something, you would eventually get to, obviously the anthropomorphism. We would get to the sense of a God working within a context. We would get the sense that God didn't create ex nihilo, that everything that exists is, self-existing, that God, organized, called, shared a plan that everybody was at choice for, and that we're still, even those that apparently chose the first estate or whatever we'd call it, that we're the 2/3 that decided to go this far, we're constantly in a process of choosing in or out or how much like God we want to be, etc. You would get them to say that. And then, like McMurrin, I know you're a McMurrinite, at least when you're in Mormon days, he talks about see, these are the metaphysical bottom of the universe kinds of things. And he simply says something like, Mormon theology developed for the most part within concrete historical context, and it wasn't derived from the metaphysics. So in other words, there's a history of our theology. And yet, although it is not chronologically prior, the metaphysics by its very nature has a kind of logical priority over the theology. For although the theological doctrines are not necessarily deducible from the metaphysical principles, the metaphysics once defined sets the limits for, and in a sense indicates the direction of theological development. For the strong intellectual tendencies of Mormonism guaranteed a continuing effort to rationalize the theology on philosophical foundations. And so when you, you know, you go ahead and call it heterodox in the sense that I would be in a position that, you know, this isn't something that would normally come up on a Sunday. I've never yet had an experience of laying out that where everyone says, no, that's outside of Mormonism. That isn't Mormonism.
Yeah. Well, I think that the average Mormon, though, would say it's better to be in the celestial kingdom than the terrestrial kingdom.
No, but they would also say it's better to be a celestial person, and that's the only kind of thing to aspire for, is not a place, but a state of...
Oh, yeah. Well, no, the place thing is just a... I mean the same thing that you're saying when I say in the celestial kingdom, I mean being a celestial person. That doesn't make a difference.
But it's purely by their choice. Their choice. It's not God at any point in the way saying yes or no, other than God. The only way God would be involved with this is, here's the mirror. Here's what I see. Here's the choices that you made. Here's the call you ignored. And guess what? You know, you're not there yet, but keep on going. You know, I'll always be there. I'll always be ministering. You know, I don't know if I take literally the Holy Ghost over the terrestrial, Jesus over the T and the C and the presence of each. But at least Mormonism has a sense of a divine call, a divine lure being presented to people at every point in there. And we can't call it eternal progression if we sense that, you know, this blip on the radar screen of eternity determines everything.
Obviously, it's still teleological. There's still some endpoint, and that still gives you a hierarchy, because you either get closer to, like, when God says to you, you're not there yet, that's still a judgment.
No, that's God simply saying, you're not a being like me yet. You know, you're not a partaker of the divine nature quite yet. But here's some areas where you need to be willing to get in the nitty gritty a little bit more. You need to give a little more patience to those that you don't want to hear from, that you don't want to interact with. I think God would be very practically always suggesting, you know, here's some practice to do.
I still think there's hierarchy there, because you make it sound like there's one path.
Okay, but you know, Dennis, just for a minute, you know, let's go back to the Buddhism analogy, because I think it works so well that I think, yeah, you know, because the Buddha would claim that there's ultimately, you know, one path. I mean, there might be...
Self-emptying is the, you know, yeah, however you get yeah. to it, you've got to do it, yeah.
Yeah, that's the thing you've got to do. The problem with Mormons, a lot of times, is we look at the, and you've caught this very well, I think, in what you've been saying, is that we look at getting to the celestial kingdom as a kind of survival of the fittest, where we are in competition with everybody else to get there. And that's to misunderstand it completely. But we do it.
I didn't mean to say that, by the way. I didn't imply that, by the way.
No, but we see it as a hierarchy that, but you'd admit that it happens among Mormons, don't you? That, you know, I there's a kind of careerism.
Oh, well, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, 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 that...
that's a human thing.
Yeah, it's a human thing. And it's also, you know, I think more of a problem in places like Utah, where Mormons are a majority or insignificant numbers. Here, you know, where I live, nobody wants to be a bishop. It's the worst job you could. It's the worst thing you could do to somebody. But you know, people do it, and you know, people think I'm weird. But I show up to church, and you know, there's so few people. You know, they need you. They don't mind that you have heterodox ideas. I think there is a kind of social problem in Utah, where, you know, you have so many, you have a culture that becomes rather oppressive and judgmental, but I think this happens everywhere. I know Hindus that are like it. I know, you know, anywhere where you get that kind of society, you know, human hierarchies develop. But on the whole, I think the reason I stay in is I believe Mormonism, and this is, you know, we were both, you know, Marxists, you know, is ultimately to, you know, at least I hope it is, to overthrow tyrants, you know, and replace them with persuasion and love. But, you know, that it's often corrupted. If you could ever convince me that that's essential to the religion, this idea of hierarchy and coercion, you know, I think I'd have to leave too.
Well, like I said, I actually think that the fundamental thing to believe if you're a Mormon is that the leadership of the church is telling you what God's will is and that you should follow the leadership of the church. To me, that's the fundamental Mormon belief. Everything else is incidental compared to that one, because anything you believe, anything else that you believe that disagrees with the hierarchy, you could end up getting kicked out for. And anytime you get a revelation that disagrees with one of your leaders, you're out. I think that there is a fact of Mormon authoritarianism and a fetishizing of the concept of obedience in Mormonism as if it's an end in and of itself. And I think that that goes back to the fact that Mormonism is an Abrahamic theism, and Abrahamic theism is a view of the world in which God can tell somebody to kill their son, and that's what they're supposed to do. And even if I recognize that there are Jews who have read that story differently, and some Mormons too who have also read that story differently, but the question is not whether the story can be read differently. The question is, what way is it read naturally by the average person? And by the average person, naturally, it's read that even if you think it's wrong, even if you think it's irrational, you ought to obey God. And once you believe that there are certain men on the planet that represent God's will, then that absolute submission to God becomes an absolute submission to them. And that explains Mormon authoritarianism. And it's pretty much fundamentally the reason why I left Mormonism. I mean, there are lots of reasons. It's a very complex thing. But when it comes down to it, the reason I left Mormonism is because I realized that I don't trust those men. I don't trust the leaders of the church. Mm-hmm. I don't trust them any more than I trust my ability to reason about things. Anytime they disagree with my ability to reason, you know, what I think is reasonable and ethical, I would always go with myself and not with them, right? But people like B.H. Roberts and Eugene England and and Orson Pratt, they all ultimately went with the leaders and denied their own views of things because the leaders disagreed with them. I think
only to preserve community, though. Only to preserve community.
Well, only to preserve community.
To be being part of that community.
I mean, it's Stalinist. It's horrible. It's horrible that people would submit to other people in that way. And I think that Abrahamic theism has that inherent to it. It's not just Mormonism. It's just Mormonism, the most extreme version of it.
Okay, let me just accept almost 95% of what you just said.
I only give him 50.
Okay, except for two things. Naturally, I don't think that there really is a natural way people read things. There is a way that it has become historically accepted. And that is actually...
That's all I mean.
Let me finish here. Bergson talks about this in The Two Sources of Morality and Religion, when he says that, and I don't want to get into philosophy, but it's just that it becomes a habit. And actually what Mormonism's supposed to do with continuing revelation is to overthrow habits. Whether it does it or not, that's the problem. Mormonism, I absolutely agree with you. You know, the church today fetishizes obedience. I taught primary. Gosh darn. That was the word we used more than almost anything else. But you've got to, and this is, we've had this discussion back in the day, that's what your job is as a philosopher or as a theologian, to try and get people to see that there's something else. Now, the hierarchy, I'm with Dan on this, the hierarchy is important to the community. It's hard to have the community without it. It's a necessary evil that I hope in the last days will be overcome. And that sounds a little bit, I know the Stalinist analogy. I've used it myself. And looking at the church office building is a lot like Kremlin watching. And if you look at some of the Stalinist art there in the church office building, it even has Joseph Smith in a white suit like Uncle Joe used to wear. It's and not looking at anybody, but just staring off into the sunset, having the great vision. It's frightening how Stalinist it is. I honestly think that most of them are trying, and it's our job, if we stay in, to try and help them see other ways. And it's also our job, though, to listen to what they say and struggle with it. That's just part of being in a community.
Yeah, this conversation confirms for me one of my theses about the nature of religious belief, and that is that the deepest differences that people have cut across religious traditions and not between them. Because, you know, when it comes down to it, we're actually, you and I, all three of us are actually agreeing quite a lot. Yeah. And probably we're agreeing with each other more than we would agree with other people in our so-called tradition. So like people in the secular, naturalist, atheist tradition that I am in a sense part of now would probably disagree with a lot of the things I've been saying to you guys. And also other people who are Mormon in your tradition would probably disagree. And to me, that actually is a hopeful thing. The fact that you can find people in any religious tradition that have a take on it that fits with your values more, and with which that you know, a take that you don't necessarily have to disagree with as vehemently as you might with the dominant view, right? Right. I mean, because your interpretation of Mormonism avoids my criticisms. I recognize that. Because it's, you no longer have gods with a big G, and
right.
But of course, then you don't have a justification for all of this submission and obedience and authoritarianism, and which to me is like, it's almost the defining characteristic of Mormonism.
Right, and that's obviously where I would want to challenge you, because again, the teachings of Mormonism don't encourage what you've just said, that the leaders are to be followed as the one major belief. Every single one of the deeper teachings is, have the experience of God yourself, become, you know, a friend of God, become the beloved of God. You know, we're the brides to the bridegroom. We are to be fully empowered. You know, even the law is to bring us to Christ, but then the law is supposed to become dead unto us. We're supposed to, you know, through the law, we've had experiences with other people, and we've changed our hearts to where now the natural flow is, you know, charity and godliness and all those different things. That's the gospel. All this other stuff is, so it may be seeming like this is the culture that fetishes us, but every one of the teachings, every one of the deeper things cut against it.
I think there's aspects of the teachings that really do reinforce this obedience thing. For one, the Abraham Isaac story, the fact that hasn't been repudiated. Another, Nephi Laban.
Well, let's repudiate it. Let's make that a point of problematizing, because it does. It needs to be.
Yeah, and then there's the fact that throughout the history of Mormonism, the very, very prominent Mormons like Orson Pratt and B.H. Roberts have defied the authorities, but then in the end caved in, and if they hadn't, they would have been kicked out. If you disagree with your religious authorities in Mormonism, you're kicked out or you're sanctioned in some way. Right. Everybody who has disagreed significantly with their leaders knows this. This happened to me. It's happened to one of my former mission companions. It's happened to the September 6th. It's happened. You know, when you disagree with an authority, yeah, you're told to find out for yourself. But you better find out for yourself what the authorities will agree with, because if you don't, they're going to sanction you. Right. That's been around in Mormon.
That's also a private thing, because certainly Joseph Smith doesn't care what you teach. You know, it feels so good not to be trammeled. I hate seeing the old man called upon this or something. And every personal encounter I've had with a general authority, any of my heterodoxy that would come up is welcomed. It's honored. It's, you know, a nod, agreement, and things like that. And it's just a question of, they've got a public role, they're general authorities, they've got to speak to the middle, they present things for those, and, you know, if you look at a Fowler sort of model or something like that, you know, the conformist, you know, received version of the world is where every religion centers, but every one of its tradition, of its teachings, every religion teaches you to go to a stage six sort of thing where it's a full mirroring, you know, embodying the divine will in and of and through yourself. So it works through you. So Jesus is pointing us to become like him, not to be someone who honors the revelation of others above their own revelation.
Well, but we have to know what Jesus says, and Mormonism solves that problem by having a hierarchy to tell you. The prophets tell you what God's will is. The leaders of the church tell you that. They can get revelation for everyone. You can only have revelation for yourself. And if your revelation conflicts with theirs, you will be sanctioned.
Only if you share it publicly.
Well, yeah, but I mean that's still bad.
Only
that's
if you claim something. I mean, there's plenty of people that put out their ideas without being sanctioned. As long as they're not calling these guys' names and calling the press and all that stuff.
But Dan, do you see how that would look to somebody on the outside? It's okay to have your opinion as long as you don't voice it. That sounds like what Lenin...
Well, I'm saying voice it, just don't challenge
them. That sounds like Leninism. That sounds like Lenin's approach to the party. Once the party has voted on something, then people cannot dissent anymore within the party. That's Bolshevism, right?
Well, things move. Salt Lake Tribune, I think today... Steve Young's keynote speaker.
Ian Barber, coming to the affirmation.
Affirmation. I mean, that's progress. You know, you work at it a little bit at a time. You keep kicking away at it. I recognize what you're saying, but I don't hold it against people who just get so frustrated with the damn thing that they leave. But if what you have to do to stay in is to believe that this is not essential to it. What Dennis thinks is that it's essential to it. If I thought it was essential to it, I'd be out too. That it's not essential. What we believe is it's not essential to it, that it's something that we've got to struggle with all the time. It's never going to go away. You know, things don't, at least not before the Messiah comes. And, that's what the struggle's about. And as long as you think that it's valuable enough to keep struggling with, you keep struggling with it.
Okay.
Yeah, or you can just leave and not have to struggle anymore because you don't have to worry about trying to obey people that don't know what they're talking about.
Well, if
freedom from instead of freedom for. I want serenity now. Serenity now. You know, George Costanza's dad. You know, kind of thing. That is a type of peace, and that's a type of.
So, I got to say, I don't know your history with the church completely, but the little bit I heard about it, I don't blame you. I mean, I probably would have too if I lived in Utah County. You know. If I get out there too much, I just start thinking about, how could I take this?
I'd love to blame leaving the church on the fact that I moved to Utah, but it was inevitable in my case because this is the point, really, when it comes down to it. This is the point that I think you guys are kind of in a state of self-deception with regard to this.
Well, you'd have to think we were.
I think most liberal Mormons are. I think that they... for example, I think Eugene England is a great example of this. He seems to be a person who thinks for himself, but in the end, he always caved in.
He wouldn't teach things that he didn't believe, though.
He always went with the official.
He didn't go with it. He would simply say, I'll be quiet about it.
Let's take another example. Guy that wrote The Backslider, Levi Peterson.
Peterson.
Yeah, I remember hearing him once in church saying that if they threw him out, he'd still show up and sing off key in the back. You know, it's McMurrin used to talk like that too. That it was, being excommunicated doesn't necessarily even mean you leave. You just kind of, okay, you excommunicated me. It's a deeper decision than that. At a certain point. And I can see how it would be, you make a decision whether you're in or out. And I can see why it would be liberating to make the decision to be out. Actually, Dennis, think that maybe you made the right decision given the circumstances. But it's not a decision I'm going to make. And I hope I'm not self-deceived about it. Right now, anyway, committed to staying in. I hope I'm not self-deceived about it, but I've got to believe I'm not, or I wouldn't still be here.
And I reject the self-deception to the point of if I felt at all that the church was Mormonism, if I felt at all that, you know, an obedience culture or, you know, anything like that were the most valuable thing about my association with Mormonism and thinking through Mormon first principles, then yeah, I would go too. But you know, I worry on those who leave, they're also forgetting the deeper teachings. They're deliberately ignoring, you know, the scriptures that I'm holding on to or the fundamental ideas that animate Mormonism as distinct from other traditions. And so I, you know, who's forgetting more is what I wonder, you know, those that leave and find peace outside it because they're ignoring the strengths, or, you know, me staying in because I'm ignoring or at least downplaying the weaknesses.
Yeah, well, I think the fact of Mormon authoritarianism and the emphasis on obedience really goes back to the fact that it's an Abrahamic theistic tradition, and its anthropomorphism just... It actually exacerbates that rather than.
Judaism's an Abrahamic tradition, and my gosh, you know, Judaism. Well, you know, it depends which variety you take, but I don't see it as authoritarian in the sense that you're describing.
But it's exclusivist. It's deeply exclusivist, and in fact, in an offensive way, we are the chosen people. That is just deeply exclusivist, and that it's that exclusivism.
Well, it depends on how you understand what chosen means.
Yeah, they it's like we're the ones to choose to bear the pain of more than others.
Yeah, well, what you're doing here is notice that you keep on redefining the terms, and that's just moving.
But those are Jews that I talk to that redefine the terms that way.
I think it's an inherent characteristic of religion is that people continually move the goalposts. Whenever there's a good criticism of one interpretation, you just redefine the terms, equivocate on the meaning of the term.
I think the world is like that, though, Dennis.
Yeah, but it's but the difference is
the world is a moving thing.
Yeah, what I think that what goes on with religious discourse is that it is indeterminate in a way that you don't get with scientific discourse. With scientific discourse, we know what we mean because we have an operational definition, right? We know how to predict what's going to happen as a result of it, and so that gives the words meanings, right? But when you've got some kind of metaphysical system that's just sort of floating, and it's not really grounded in the world, at least not in one particular way. It's grounded in all sorts of different ways. Then you never really know what people mean. But I mean,
the world is not reducible to auto mechanics.
If I had this conversation with two average Mormons, it would be a totally different conversation. They would be defending the need to obey the authorities. Most Mormons would be doing that. Only Sunstone Mormons would be taking the approach that you guys are taking, right? I mean, I know that you think it's the
until I gave them a 5-minute primer on our metaphysics, and then they're all with me.
Yeah, you're very optimistic.
Well, I've experimented upon that, and it's worked.
Oh, okay.
I've experimented on it too, and it hasn't.
Let me ask: was there something else you wanted us to talk about?
That's the thing. We've been getting away from God, and the other piece of the God stuff that came up in the longer discussion that we haven't really addressed here was sort of this Dennis, you know, any personal God, any God, the way we would look at Mormonism, and you know, we'll all agree, even it's a small G or a capital G God in terms of a personal being. Dennis was seeming to say that I can never really, you know, there's a sense of a lack of guarantee. There's always a contingency. There's always a possibility of being rejected or something. And that seemed to be a fundamental temperamental difference between Dennis that I think drives him in some of the directions versus the temperament that Jim and I at least seem to have. So I don't know, Dennis, do you remember the piece where you were talking about, you know, wanting a God that kind of, you know, if you're going to call a God, make it a God that really can guarantee stuff.
Well, yeah, if you're going to put all of your heart, might, mind, and strength into something, then you don't want it to be risky. If it's possible for that thing to go awry, to go the wrong direction, then it doesn't make sense for you. You need to have a plan B, right? You need to be able to back out of it. And I think that when you, the more you anthropomorphize God, the more risky you make it for you to throw your eggs in that basket, right? I do believe this: if the Mormon God does exist, I wouldn't recognize him as God.
Well,
if I find out,
right?
Find out that I am really a spirit child of an immortal being. I wouldn't see him as my Lord. I wouldn't see him as God. Right, I just wouldn't, because he would be in an environment. He would be dependent on other things. I would want to figure out the laws of the universe and understand those things in the way that, you know, maybe he does. But I would never be able to know that he does. Right, you could never know that an embodied being has the kinds of characteristics that would need to have in order to place all of your trust in them. You just can't know that. They're like other human beings. Even if they would have been perfect up till now, they might not be perfect the next moment that they act.
Right. Okay.
You know, yeah. I mean, they're so Jews. Mormons don't embrace this. They don't embrace this the way that some Jews do. Howard Wettstein, in his book, The Significance of Religious Experience, just says, look, the Jewish God can make mistakes. He can make mistakes in terms of rationality, mm-hmm. make mistakes in terms of morality. And I want to say that's actually exactly true of the Mormon concept of God as you guys are advocating it. And I think that the fact that he can make mistakes means that I shouldn't totally trust him. Maybe I should take a lot of stock in what he says. Maybe I should, like, listen to him and in the same way that I would listen
there's listening, and then there's actually doing the experiments that God says. Try it out for yourself.
Well, that's what
become
I was just saying.
Like
I was
me.
Saying maybe
there's
I should
no.
Listen to
them. It's more
maybe
than listen.
Listen to him. Maybe I should try it out and see if it works, like I would with the Buddhist. But it might not. And if it doesn't, see that's where the difference is.
If you get
the conclusion in Mormonism that they've got it wrong, then you're going to be sanctioned, right? If
okay,
you disagree with your bishop, you're sanctioned.
Dennis, okay. Let me use the word trust. You're going to get me saying that I'm slipping the word here again. But when I think of trust, I usually think of trust is that I trust that the other person is trying to do the best they can do. That I trust a person who is... has a good heart, that God would be morally actually not out, you know, this is the Buddhist thing again, that has overcome his self, has overcome his selfishness, has become pure love. I would trust. Could that God make mistakes? Sure. I really like Edgar Sheffield Brightman's idea that God is, what is it he says? Man is a problem for God. God is a problem for man. And what might shock us is God is probably also a problem for himself. But I still would trust that God. But now, Dennis, you know, and I know you're, this I think you can agree with me on, because you don't like that God either. I mean, you know, at least in personalistic terms, because you're a good anarchist. And, you know, you want to overthrow all tyrants. The one that isn't the complete lord and master of the universe. Anything like that, you know, that's a tyrant. You want to get rid of that.
This isn't coming out of my anarchism, though. I mean, I recognize that if the Catholic God existed, it would make sense for me to submit to him. But I don't think the Catholic God exists.
You wouldn't.
However,
exist?
If the Mormon God existed, it would not be nonsensical or irrational for me to not submit to him. Mm-hmm. That's where the difference is.
Dennis, God would admit that. Wouldn't God simply say, yeah, it's all I can do is offer my example. Go find another part of the universe to go find a better God. Isn't that the Mormon position? Isn't risk inherent in the whole thing? Wasn't this whole council in heaven, it's a nice story mythically, whether it happened or not. It at least explains the temperaments of, you know, do I want to take the known versus the unknown? Do I want to, grow just a little, or do I want to risk and roll big? And Mormons at least celebrate risk.
Yeah, well, the idea that by risk you're going to, by by risk, you're going to, things are going to go better, is itself fundamentally problematic. It's part of the American ethos. It's why gambling's so popular here, why capitalism's so popular here. But the idea that risk is somehow a good thing inherently, I think, is deeply problematic.
But yet you prove it each and every day. If you risk in this direction or if you risk in that direction, it's proved in your own life and your experience as to whether or not you continue to risk in that way. And it's not like you're making a once and for all decision within Mormonism. I can't remember if it was this or the other, you know, longer discussion that this is a shorter version of, but somewhere along the line, we say we've never stopped choosing. We never stop deciding, do I want to experience that level of crap or that level of enjoyment? There's always going to be that choice. It's never a once and for all thing. And especially if we're uncreated beings, we never can go out of existence. We can only just decide to be bigger or smaller. It makes perfect sense to risk.
Yeah, well, maybe you like capitalism then. I don't.
Okay, Dennis.
I think that it doesn't make sense. When, for example, it doesn't make sense to do something that might kill you. There are certain levels of risk, I mean, that are okay, right? Because you're able to, you know, you're able to be cautious enough to keep yourself from being killed doing some kind of activity that you really enjoy, like riding your bike. So you put a helmet on. Right. It would be more risky to not wear a helmet when you ride your bike, but that would just be stupid. It would just be stupid to not wear a helmet when you ride your bike.
But I don't think he's saying that we risk just for the sake of risk.
Right.
Yeah, that's what it sounds like, that somehow risk is somehow inherently connected to progress. And I don't think that that's right. I don't think that's the right way to see it. I know that is part of the American ethos, but
I think it's just that it's, if you believe in anything like free will, you just think that it's the what?
I definitely do not believe in free will.
Okay, but if you do, if you know, and Mormons kind of have to.
Yeah, there's one of the ones that Jim and I are very orthodox.
But you end up with the idea that you never can completely eliminate this risk thing. It's just going to be there.
Oh, well, yeah, and I'm not saying that that if you can't eliminate it, that would be a problem. You just want to minimize it, I think.
I don't think there's any disagreement.
It makes sense in life to be cautious and not do stupid things, you know, like, oh, well, I'm gonna improve myself and I'm going to go do some base jumping and become a greater person as a result of doing this base jumping. No, that's just a stupid thing to do.
Yeah, and I agree with you on the American ethos as far as that goes, that, you know, yeah, that's crazy.
I mean, that's how Mitt Romney justifies the fact that he has all the wealth that he does.
Because he says, well, I took the risk
with my investment, I'm justified in having this. And I just, you know, I don't. The idea that risk is somehow some kind of good thing, which William James, of course, you know, advocated in his book Pragmatism.
I disagree with you on James there. I think he's saying that it's just inevitable.
Right.
Yeah,
but he's saying human temperament goes that direction too.
I just want to point out something else, though.
Oh, no, I just have to say one thing before you point out something else. I cannot. I've known you 20 years. I cannot imagine you, even if if the Catholic God showed up and convinced you he was there. I can't imagine you just giving in.
Well, the Catholic God couldn't show up. That's important. It's important to recognize that you can only know that the Catholic God exists by an argument. You can't know that the Catholic God doesn't show up. But here's the important thing: the Mormon God doesn't show up either. Only an embodied person shows up, and showing that embodied person's a deity is a totally different thing. And the fact that he can do some magic tricks, that he's supernatural, or even that we have some kind of history with him that we can remember, none of that shows that he's in any way worthy of worship.
Once again, the Buddha. Somebody. Now, how do you know the Buddha's the Buddha?
Yeah. Well, I mean, in that case, Buddhism is different, though, because Buddhism doesn't say to you, you know, you're going to need to believe this or you're damned, right, in some sense.
Buddhism says you're going to keep going around, which I think is essentially what Mormonism says. You're going to keep going around until you get this right.
There's a more possibility than that, because, I mean, you know, I get the sense, at least, I mean, I'm not an expert. I talk too much about Buddhism, probably, since I'm not much of an expert on it. But I have read a lot of it in the last several years because I was very interested in it. In fact, I actually even thought about becoming a Buddhist at one point. But
me too.
Taoist for
me. It's really clear to me with Buddhism, at, like the Dalai Lama expresses this a lot. Look, where Buddhism might be wrong in some places, and so you just have to try it out for yourself and see if we're right. We think we're right, but we might be wrong. Now, there's in fact, where we're wrong, the Dalai Lama famously says, for example, if Buddhism and science conflict, it's Buddhism that has to give, not science. Right, that's not the attitude that you get in the Abrahamic theisms, including Mormonism.
We got to take that one on, or else we're gonna just continue in circles.
Yeah, let me say something about trust though, because that was, when it comes down to it, it's whether you can trust God or not, and that was an important point here. Jim said that trust doesn't necessarily require that you know that they're going to do the right thing for you.
No, that's not what I said.
Say it again so that I can...
That they would have absolute knowledge about everything.
Yeah, okay, so it doesn't require... But see, here's the thing. The fact that somebody has good intentions is not enough of a reason to trust them, because they can be idiots, or they could be dysfunctional. And they could have really good intentions and be idiots and do bad things, or they can have really good intentions and be dysfunctional and do bad things. And so that doesn't mean... You know, I mean, somebody who really likes you but makes a lot of mistakes, you're not going to trust them in the sense that I'm talking about, right? And that's the sense that I would need to trust in.
But we're not going to get absolute certainty. Trust isn't to have absolute certainty.
No, it's not absolute certainty that I'm requiring.
But that's the same thing with me with God. I'm not going to have absolute certainty, but I'm going to trust him. It's the best shot I can take. The risk cannot be completely eliminated.
Yeah.
And the trust is warranted or not in your own body, Jim, in your own experience. I mean, there's no decision that's made once and for all.
Yeah. Well.
Okay. So this Abrahamic tradition thing. Yeah. I mean, so Mormonism, in its 200 years, hasn't really developed a healthy critique of the Abraham and Isaac story. We certainly, in our patriarchal blessings, want to go, we tie into Abrahamic covenant.
Faith.
Yeah. And we do all those things. So definitely Abraham is a big player, and the promises made to Abraham are a big player in Mormonism and things like that. But somehow or other, I think that you're not still saying that you can do the Abrahamic thing, and you could legitimately critique the account, or at least the reading or the understanding of Abraham being honored for his obedience, in that situation. You're kind of saying that Mormonism can't challenge those different things, and with its understanding of God, it even makes it easier to challenge scriptures like that, because we have the human interpreter in at every step of the way. There's no place where God overrides human expectation, the story that you've inherited and things like that. God simply works and tweaks with it, and hopefully enough of divine mojo, it exists around these stories that that you feel empowered to say, these are rich stories, and I'm empowered to go in lots of different directions with them.
Well, I'm sure there's a way to Mormons can, and in fact, most Mormons that I know actually tell me that they don't believe, because I ask Mormons all the time this, do you believe that God told Abraham to kill his son? And a lot of Mormons tell me no, so they don't really believe.
So good.
They don't really believe the story, but here's the thing, it's all over the place in the manuals, it's all over the place in General Conference, and it's constant. Obedience is necessary. Abraham is an example of obedience. Nephi killing Laban is another example of obedience, and those are two people that I find to be moral reprobates because of what they did. Abraham should be seen as a moral reprobate. Nephi should be seen as a moral reprobate for killing Laban. Records? Come on, this is crazy.
Or at least
somebody thinks that's an ethical thing to do is insane.
Okay, but at least grant what Grant Hardy gives to Nephi. He's a middle-aged guy looking back on some event in his life and trying to make sense of it or something. And so him moral reprobate because of an action that he thought was right. The fact that it got in.
How could you think it's right? If you think that's right,
I'm just saying he's working. I don't know. I give him, again, I don't know that Nephi is a real being, but there at least is an internal life there that I think can be read into that story. It's not an objectively true story that God commanded him to lop off the head of a drunk guy that's given him a little grief at the moment.
I'm sure it's been, one thing, though, that I think is really fascinating here with that story And, you know, I've never heard anybody make anything of it, and I think it's got to have been done, is that what the Spirit tells Nephi is almost exactly what Caiaphas says about
Christ. Yeah, Jesus, yeah. That's...
Yeah. Has somebody ever talked about that? I mean, you know, that's always disturbed me. That
it's better that one should perish than a whole nation dwindle in unbelief.
Yeah.
Well, I'm glad that there are Mormons like you guys that don't take those stories seriously. But what scares me are not Mormons.
I take them seriously. I just don't know what to do with them.
Well, no, they don't take them literally. Don't believe the story on its face value.
Well, in the last 10, 12 years, Dennis, if I'm in an environment at church that is open to discussion, I've problematized it every single time, and people are nodding like crazy. I mean, they may forget it because they have to be exposed to the critique several times, but every single time, people will kind of come the direction towards a less certain, you know, that this is the only way to look at this, or that God really commanded that. It just works, but you got to be there, and you got to earn their trust, and you got to be able to know what you're talking about. So yeah, that's Mormonism to me.
Yeah, but that's not the Mormonism I'm worried about. I'm not worried about Dan Witherspoon blowing things up or telling gay kids that they're evil or, you know, imposing gender essentialism on a whole group of people or denying blacks the priesthood. I'm not worried about Dan Witherspoon doing that. I'm worried about the Mormon Church doing that. I'm worried about those guys in the building.
And then who's going to hedge against it? It's only going to be folks that have stayed in and you know, continue the work.
I think that the obedience aspect of Mormonism is there, and I think it is connected to those stories, and I think it is connected to how they understand the nature of God, even if there are some ways of reading Mormonism that avoid those. And it's interesting, the interesting ways are ways that make Mormonism a lot more like Eastern traditions, in particular, kind of like Buddhism. And you know, I mean, if I had stayed Mormon, you know, I would have been interested in going that direction with Mormon theology. I think it's horrible. It's horrible, just absolutely horrible that Mormonism has gone in the direction of evangelical Christianity.
Yeah.
And they've tried to be bedfellows with evangelicals. So we agree and we disagree. We agree on what the criticisms of the mainline Mormonism is. We disagree on whether it's Mormonism or not. Or not whether it's Mormonism or not, because I want to say there's no fact of the matter as to what Mormonism is, but it's the Mormonism that I'm concerned with, and it's what I'm criticizing when I say things like I do, you know. Because the average Mormon, I would say, does think that they should worship God in the sense that we talked about before, and I think that that's connected to their commitment to obedience to the leaders. And if you can disrupt the idea that we should that God is worshipable, then you can disrupt that obedience to the leaders idea as well. I ideas have consequences, and I'm judging them by their consequences mostly, not by you know, whether it makes speculative sense or not. Does that make sense?
But then on the other, I see your point, you know, but it's, I have friends who are evangelicals who are, you know, leftists. And what, you know, I think, these massive religious movements aren't going away. You know, I'm taking the position of an outsider, not a believer. You need people within the groups who are willing to move them to other understandings of what they are, and to use the resources that come out of the tradition in order to do that. Now, you know, at a certain point, for some people, that's going to become impossible, because sometimes the groups just, you know, it just becomes too oppressive. But at that point, we're in real trouble, you know, because then all that's going to be left, and, you know, in the long way, you know, this is, I think, a problem with American religion today. If you go back to the 30s, 40s, 50s, and 60s, to the, you know, the civil rights movement, to, you know, the mainstream churches in the United States, the social gospel, a lot of the advance in civil rights and in social justice came out of them.
Right.
As they sort of fall apart, and you have more conservative and fundamentalist movements gain power.
Because they offer shelter from the storm, stability in a chaotic world. Yeah, people are risk adverse in many ways.
Then, what's happened what's happened in this country in the last 40 years, with all that we've lost of the New Deal and the Great Society. And I don't know, I think, this is a fight that has to go on. And there has to be a kind of revitalization of, liberal Christianity, or at least the Christianity that's concerned with social justice and with peace and with, and I think that's true within Mormonism as well. Mm-hmm. I actually think we've improved in the last 10 years within Mormonism. Maybe I'm being optimistic, but...
I think you're right. I think the internet and the connectivity that comes from social networking has helped a lot with that. It helps people who are dissenters or heterodox know that there are other people who think the same way.
I don't think the church is going to do Proposition 8 ever again.
Right.
Or even September 6th.
I don't think that's going to happen ever again.
And
you read, and I think somebody, I'm optimistic. I don't think the church is going to, become a Christian anarchist group anytime soon. I think that it's improving, and I think that the struggle needs to keep going, and you need people. Not just on the inside, but people on the outside to criticize it, but to criticize it in the way that that you do, in a kind of sympathetic way that is actually concerned not just with destroying it, but with the good of the thing.
I think the fundamental thing, when you're an outsider, because I really am an outsider now, I have to admit that I have a hard time understanding Mormonism now that I'm outside. Mm-hmm. I mean, my conversion to the naturalism that I now embrace, I don't see it as a deconversion from Mormonism. It's a conversion into another way of seeing things has made it so that it's actually difficult for me to understand my former self. And so in talking to Mormons, I want to understand why I was committed to it before when I can't fathom how I could possibly have been committed to it now that when I look back at it. It's about mutual understanding as much as it is about trying to criticize and help people move in the direction that you want them. I just want to understand it. I want to understand what people think, why people think what they do, right? No matter what religious tradition they're in. And so that's why outside criticism is really good, because it helps you realize how you sound to people on the outside.
Yeah.
Mormons, unlike some of the Christian traditions that have been around for a long time, Mormons are not very used to talking to people from the outside or looking at their religion the way it looks from the outside. They're very narcissistic or, sort of navel-gazing in their discussion of Mormonism. And I think that it's helpful to talk to people who aren't Mormon and to really try to talk about Mormonism using the language that everyone else uses instead of using your own particular contorted version of that language. I think that's
to explain what you mean when you're using your own contorted version of that.
Yeah,
right.
But it should be better to just use the same language that everybody else is using. I mean, it's not helpful to fight over words. It's better to just
but they're wrong.
Because Mormons will lose that fight. They're right. They're using the words correctly. You're not
no, wrong. No. Only if you assume that there's a certain Platonic meaning to words.
They don't change over time.
All you have to assume is that there's a history to the word, and the history of the word omnipotence implies that Robert's version of it is erroneous.
No, I'm coming out of process here. Process uses some of the same, Process will use the word omnipotence. They'll use the word omniscience, but they'll say, this is not what it means.
Yeah.
And they'll say it means something more like Robert's said it meant. Now, that doesn't mean that and people in open theist traditions within the evangelical world do the same thing.
Let me give you another example of, another way in which Mormons equivocate on terms that is irritating. Mormons, on the one hand, have this doctrine of apostasy, which is essentially the idea that all of the other Christian traditions are not truly Christian. And they need there need to be a restoration of the true Christianity. So the basically Mormons start off by saying the restoration is all about saying, okay, you guys are not really Christian, we are. And then later, when the rest of the Christian tradition say to Mormons, hey, you know what, you're not Christian because you don't believe in the doctrine of the Trinity and so on, right? Grace, you don't really believe in grace, you're kind of you're Pelagian and so on. So you're not really Christian for those reasons. Mormons say, no, yeah, yeah, we're Christian. We're Christian even in those in that sense. And what they're
doing
is,
look at the name of our church.
Yeah, they're equivocating. What they're doing is they're equivocating. On the one hand, they're using Christian in one sense, and on the other hand, they're using Christian in another sense. And that's moving the goalpost. It's equivocating. It's ambiguous. Get clear about your language. And there's a lot of that. Mormons are way more problematic in this regard than, say, Catholics are. Catholics know what they're talking about when they're using this kind of language, and they really they get clear on the definitions, right? Mormons don't. And it makes it very difficult. I don't – I half the time when I'm talking to Mormons about this kind of stuff, I don't know for sure what they're saying because I'm not sure what they mean by the language that they're using. And it would be very helpful if we had some – maybe we just need a neutral language, right? Same kind of thing happens with Marxism too, though, because, you know, Leninists and Stalinists and Maoists all believe that communism is one thing, and left communists, all the unorthodox Marxists in the West, believe that communism is a totally different thing. And if they describe it, it's – two radically different kinds of things that they describe. Mm-hmm. So they use the same word to mean completely different things, and they end up talking past each other. I think a lot of that happens. I mean, that's one of the things that I've noticed most with trying to talk about theology with Mormons since leaving is that we end up talking about words half the time instead of talking about the actual views.
Right. That's a fun place to kind of wind down, because we're moving away from God again and the Mormon concept of God versus others and worship worthiness and all that stuff. I hope we've
and we've been going for about an hour and a half.
yeah we did. So anyway, we'll I think it was a little more focused for those that stick around for the other one. What you're going to get is a lot more technical philosophy. You'll hear some of this stuff, but I would say only maybe a quarter of it really was covered there, right? Of what we really wrestled with. It became much more of a, you know, personalism versus Spinoza's philosophy and Dennis's articulation of why he favors things along those directions. So much more technically philosophical on that one. But let me just give each of you, you know, a couple of minutes or whatever for whatever you for sure want to say in terms of either I want to make sure that this point that I was trying to make gets made, or if you just want to make some kind of general comment about how you hope people will listen to this podcast and how it might affect, you know, affect them as they try to have a takeaway. Dennis, you want to go first?
Okay. Well, I mean, the basic idea that kind of led, I think, to all this discussion, it's what got me to post my stuff on Facebook, was just that even if the sort of the factual things that Mormonism claims are true about the universe, in other words, there, like, for example, there's an immortal being who fits the description of the Mormon God, that doesn't mean that that's the only description that will actually make sense out of the universe. You could describe the Mormon God as a immortal, extraterrestrial, with quite a bit of wisdom that maybe we should listen to him instead of describing him as God, and that those two descriptions are equally rational, they're equally defensible, and so it follows that it's not rationally compelling for someone to worship that being. Now, I think that you guys actually probably agree with me on this.
Right.
That would be actually my fundamental point is that point.
Okay.
Yeah. So the reason that that you can describe the Mormon God in some other way other than being a god is because he's anthropomorphic, right? That's why I can say he's an immortal extraterrestrial instead of saying that he's a god.
Right. And that's And again, Jim and I guess aren't that worried about it. I know the Mormon transhumanists are not that worried about, you know, this idea of it's simply an advanced being, and at some point you would say that's a different species than us, and we're comfortable saying calling that person a god. You know, that seems to be a trajectory, at least, that those guys are on, and certainly not one that scares me away from wanting to use the term god.
Yeah, Dennis, one thing that it's funny that we would disagree on this. We do agree on it, but I mean, disagree on the word God in one sense, because I take it that one of my favorite authors is Ludwig Feuerbach.
Mm-hmm.
And I took it that Dennis, you're an admirer of Feuerbach, aren't you?
Yeah.
Yeah. And well, if you read The Essence of Christianity, remember what he says about the gods in there is that those polytheistic ones are more real because they have flesh and blood. Whereas as it becomes more and more abstract, it becomes and absorbs everything, you know, like a vampire out of human being, all of human value, but also becomes the projection of human value and becomes more and more distant. It also dies. And human beings discover that they were it all the time. And Feuerbach's like my favorite atheist. I mean, I have a lot of atheists. I have Sartre I love. But Dennis is also one of my favorite atheists. Because, you know, one of my favorite philosophers, Berdyaev, said it is to the greatest glory of God that he could create a being that was free enough to deny him. So...
And
that's
supposed to be a compliment. And that totally fits for me within the Mormon concept of that God really would honor that. You know, I just don't see that God would reject Dennis at all for not believing.
I could believe in his existence without believing that he's God.
Okay. Interesting. Yeah. Interesting.
Oh, by the way, I would disagree with Feuerbach on that one thing, because I do think that... I think there's a bias in a lot of philosophy, and especially in Mormon theology, that the concrete is more real than the abstract. But I think we have every reason to think that the abstract is more real than the concrete. And of course, I'm like Plato.
Yeah, as I say, straight Plato.
Listen to the 2-hour discussion here. This is where Dennis and I. really go off on each other. Yeah. Okay.
Definitely. The critique of Plato definitely is there. Well, good. So Dennis, jump back in, you know, I let you go first. Jim, where would you want to sum things up either in terms of remaking points?
That was my summary right there. So I'm just happy to have been able to talk about this with you guys. I've been for years now, I've been wanting to talk to Dennis about this because I just, you know, I was just so disappointed, not that he left the church, but that he became a Spinozist. I got to say, too, that there was a time, you know, and this is part of the irony of this, is there was a time when I was thinking about leaving the church, but I met Dennis. And Dennis was one of the reasons I stayed, because he, you know, he seemed like, you know, such a revolutionary to me, and yet he was a Mormon.
Nice.
So I want to thank Dennis for that. That's maybe I should end right there. That it's a pleasure to be able to talk to you about this, and I'm not that disappointed. You're a Spinozist. I like Spinoza, but you know it's. You've got to add some Hegel and Schelling in there. So, yeah.
Yeah, I think you're right about the Hegel. I don't know Schelling, but yeah.
It would bring in the...
I have been convinced that contradiction is at the core of reality, but not by Hegel, by Graham Priest, the famous logician in Australia. I think he's one of the... He might even be the greatest living philosopher, and people don't realize it because his work's so esoteric. But I do think that I think you're right about Hegel.
Okay.
In fact, I think maybe Hegel's just right. The absolute. Hegel's absolute.
That's fun.
That's the object of my ultimate concern. Hegel's absolute.
Well, you guys are amazing. You are also a kind of a you know, my own career took me away from being in the academy like you guys are. And so whenever I get involved with these things, I just think of what my life would have been. And this would have been the de rigueur of my life. And I love it and I'm attracted to it. On the other hand, you know, I recognize that my life called me to more of a theologian and especially a pastoral theologian, you know, sort of a dial it down public theologian type guy. And so I hope that's what Mormon Matters kind of models. You know, we certainly are wonderfully honored to have you guys and to have technical discussions and things like that. But whenever we can, I always want to take it to where it's tire meets the road. And if I were just to repeat any of my things, you know, it would simply be, we're never done. None of these, you know, I always, you know, want to preach patience. Dennis preaches caution, you know, very well. Let's not take unnecessary risks and things like this. But I always wanted to simply say, if you're gonna make a decision, make it with the best of Mormonism, you know, make it with the deeper teachings, make it with all the beautiful gifts that it brings in terms of very practical spirituality, lived experience, putting you in the chance to be of service to others, all those different things, you know, make it with the full richness of it, rather than just the obedience culture, the, you know, God judges and things like that, because that's not what our teachings at their core. Again, I'll just have to go back to the McMurrin quote about metaphysics. Somewhere along the line, everyone recognizes that those things cast the final stone. Those things have more weight than just how they've been interpreted and how they get talked about on a daily basis. So, you know, that's what I try to throw here with Mormon Matters is at least a reminder that there's richness and that our view of God is worthy of being in a discussion like this, along with traditional, you know, views that Dennis is, you know, using to problematize ours. And we're grateful for those critiques, but I think Mormonism can hold its own. So that's my final area there. Throw any rebuttals to that?
No, we'll let you have the last word.
Yeah, it's your show, Dan.
Thanks for having me on. I really enjoyed talking to you and Jim about this. I have wanted to talk to smart, philosophically trained Mormons about Mormonism, just so that I can help understand my former self. So this has been great.
Well, thanks, Dennis.
Thank you, Dennis, for being here. We love having you. It's a great blessing to know that we're helping you with self-understanding, and we just love your mind, and we're so glad you're engaging with Mormons again, with Mormon theology, no matter, you know, if it's mostly in the form of critique, it is with a friendly heart, so we love that. All right, appreciate you guys. Thanks, Mormon Matters audience. Keep the donations coming, if you will. Lots of podcasts are going to be flowing out of here, I bet even more than one a week for the next little bit. So we're going to keep you busy listening, and I hope you'll continue to enjoy and support it. And we wish everybody a good night.
Good night.
Good night.
Cue the music.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Matters Podcast. To discuss this podcast with others, please check us out at mormonmatters.org. To keep this podcast alive, or to join our support community, please consider a tax-deductible donation today at mormonmatters.org. Music for this podcast was brought to you by Brittany and Clayton Pixton. The Mormon Matters logo was generously provided by StudioCase.com. Thank you for listening.